So Isaiah chapter 13, we get into a new section, which really brings us up to the end of the first half of the book of Isaiah. You'll recall that Isaiah had been, in the previous section, talking about God's coming redemption in terms of a second exodus. And in chapter 12, he gives his own new covenant spin on the on the Song of Moses, praising God for his mighty acts of redemption. And then in chapter 13, we have the beginning of the oracles against the nations. Here in chapter 13, in the chapters that follow, you'll see Isaiah bringing these oracles or these prophetic words against the surrounding nations of Israel. Beginning with Babylon, but also mentioning Assyria, Egypt, Cush, Moab, Edom, to the north, to the south, east and west, Philistia, all of these surrounding nations which had been plaguing Israel for their entire history, we have oracles of judgment being brought against them. We see this not only in the book of Isaiah, but we also see this in the book of Jeremiah, as well as Ezekiel. They have these dedicated sections of the oracles against the nations. And I think we could pause and ask, what is the purpose of these oracles? These oracles against the nations were not written to the nations. It's not as if Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel were proclaiming these things and saying, hey, let's send this off to them as words of warning. Different than, you know, the ministry of the prophet Jonah, who actually went to Nineveh, one of the main cities of the Assyrian Empire. And, you know, he had to tell them 40 days Nineveh would be destroyed. And to his own chagrin, it resulted in, you know, national repentance. And that's why I didn't want to do it in the first place. That's not the point of these oracles. It's not necessarily for the spiritual benefit of the inhabitants of those nations at the time. I would say the immediate purpose of including these oracles in these prophetic books is for the benefit of the people of God. As they are plagued by their enemies all around them, as they live in constant fear and threat of invasion, they are given the assurance that ultimately the Lord will prevail and give them the victory. And part of having the victory is to be able to experience the defeat of your enemies. Okay? To be able to know that those enemies will be put down, that their mighty, you know, their all of their might and splendor will ultimately be upended. And so part of our living hope, part of our, the thing that we're looking forward to when Jesus comes back is that he will destroy both his and our enemies. Right? We tend to think of terms of salvation in a personal sense where, you know, our sins are forgiven, we're justified, and we will ultimately be glorified. Well, that's true, but also part of our salvation, something that the Israelites would be more mindful of, is also part of our salvation is the destruction of all of our enemies. Okay, so that is sort of the primary point here, even to such an extent that what we have in here is not just the prediction, in prophetic terms of the fall of Babylon or whatever nations, but you also have the taunts of the people of God, right? We're not really used to taunting so much unless you're a sports fan. You know, you might be taunting your opponents, and things like that. But if you look at the Old Testament and even as we'll see in the New, there are taunts. That the people of God and songs of rejoicing at the downfall of our enemies. One thing I want to highlight, if you want to jump back to chapter 10, we have in chapter 10 again. Remember the immediate context, the immediate or the more near threat that the Israelites are facing that Isaiah is predicting is the Assyrian threat. And he says that the Assyrians will destroy the northern kingdom of Israel and will come really close, right up to the neck of Jerusalem. and, you know, shave, you know, get so close, it says, you know, he's shaving them as a razor. But in chapter 10, we have sort of God's philosophy of history and how he works with the nations, how he uses wicked nations to accomplish his most holy and wise purposes. So look in chapter 10, verse 5, Isaiah says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury." So here you see that the Lord is speaking of the wicked Assyrian army as the rod of his anger and the staff of his fury in his hands. He's using this Assyrian army as, you know, a pawn, as an instrument to accomplish his purposes, namely the punishment and chastisement of his people. But the tables are going to be turned on them, which is why Isaiah is saying, "Woe to you," right? It's not a privilege that you're being used by God to punish the people, but that punishment will come back on your head. So he goes on to say, "Against a godless nation I send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him." So the godless nation, of course, is Israel, who has forsaken God. The him is Assyria, right? "To take spoil and seize plunder and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. But he does not so intend, and his heart does not so think, but in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few." So you'll notice that the intent of the Assyrian generals and the Assyrian king and the Assyrian nation, they're not mindful of the fact that they're being used by God to punish Israelites. They have it in their mind to kill, steal, and destroy, right? To plunder and to conquer, right? That's what they're thinking. All the while, God is using them for his most holy and wise purposes. Okay, so skipping down to verse 15, God is speaking in terms of using the Assyrian army as a tool. In this case, it's an axe. "Shall the axe boast over him who hews with it? Or the saw magnify itself against him who wields it? As if a rod should wield him who lifts it, or as if a staff to lift him who is not wood." And so here the idea is, God is saying that the Assyrian army, even though they boast as if saying, "Look, we're accomplishing this on our own," God's saying, "No, you're just a tool in my hands." Okay, so that's just setting the stage for the oracles of the nations, if you want to skip to chapter 13, for how God uses the nation, the surrounding nations of Israel, his people. Although they are wicked, and they are, in their minds, they're doing wicked things, God is using them to accomplish his good purposes. But at the end of the day, he will reverse that judgment and turn that wickedness back on them. Okay, so that's sort of the overarching thing. But all that that being said, even in the midst of these oracles of the nations, which will continue, as I said, he begins with Babylon. You have Assyria mentioned, you have Philistia, you have Moab. You have included amongst these oracles Jerusalem, which is termed the Valley of Vision. And so the people of God themselves are not exempt from the imminent doom and destruction which will come upon them as a result of their sin. But also, in the midst, sort of interspersed in these prophecies, oracles of doom and gloom and destruction, you have promises of salvation and inclusion of people from these nations as part of the people of God. So that's another thing that we want to be watching for as you read these chapters. Okay. Next thing I want to highlight is the fact that Isaiah begins his oracles against the nations with the nation of Babylon. And this is fascinating because at this point, the world power in the 8th century when Isaiah lived, the biggest threat, the one that he had been prophesying against, was not the Babylonians, but who? The Assyrians, right? The Assyrians. And And so at this point, the Babylonians, Babylon, was struggling for their own existence. Okay? So it's interesting and ironic that in the 8th century BC, Isaiah begins with Babylon. It would be like today, you know, you think of the mighty world powers, the emerging world powers, of course, the United States, you have China, you know, you can think of that. It'd be like Isaiah's, you know, saying, woe to you, Guatemala. You know, that you are going to come and you're going to, you know, speaking in terms of like, his original audience would be like, Babylon, I've never even heard of the place. Well, they would have heard of it, actually, as I'll highlight. But it, this leads many critical scholars to say Isaiah could not have written chapter 13. Now, you'll recall in our introduction how critical scholars will want to divide the book of Isaiah into two main sections. You have chapters 1 through 39, and then you have chapters 40 to the end. And they'll say, clearly, Isaiah could not have written chapters 40 and onward. Why? Do you want to remember why? Right, you have the predictive prophecy, even so specific as naming the guy, Cyrus, right? You have it written from the perspective of the Babylonian exile, writing as if it's a done thing, like it's historical fact, and then looking forward from that perspective. So essentially the reason why, I mean, there's other reasons people could give, but it boils down to the fact that these critical scholars deny predictive prophecy. They say it's impossible to predict the future, and so therefore Isaiah could not have written the second half of the book. But here we find ourselves in the first half of the book, right? And you'll notice the superscription of this oracle, verse 1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which who? Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw. So it's explicitly attributed to him. So you can't, so you couldn't get anyone saying, or I don't think you can have anyone honestly say, well, it was someone else who wrote it. Right? Because, you know, Isaiah's name doesn't appear in chapters 40 through 66. So they say, well, it's somebody else. Well, no, it's explicitly attributed to Isaiah. So it boils down to, you know, denying the ability of God to predict the future, which is a big point that God makes in the second half of the book where he says he challenges the idols of the nations. Hey, prove that you're God by predicting the future. Predict something. And make it happen. That's God. That's what God is claiming the ability to do in the book of Isaiah. And here it's displayed. Okay, so not only is he predicting the fall of Babylon, but Isaiah is predicting the rise of Babylon. Even when it's not even, you know, you can't even read the tea leaves and kind of predict it as if it's about to happen. No, it's far out into the future. Okay. But also, I think it's important that Isaiah begins with Babylon, not only because Babylon will be the ultimate tool in God's hands to bring destruction against the tribe of Judah and the city of Jerusalem, but also because in the Bible, Babylon is the archetypal sin city. Babylon, from the very beginning, stands for sin and rebellion against God. We see this at the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, where Babylon is portrayed as a harlot, right, as a great prostitute, as the sort of symbol of all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, as a symbol of this fallen world system in rebellion against God and in opposition to the people of God, right? Persecuting the saints, right? So Babylon is portrayed in that sense at the end of the book of the Bible, but even at the beginning, in the book of Genesis, we're told about Babylon. You might say, well, where in the book of Genesis? Well, just keep your finger here in Isaiah 13 and flip to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10, we're given the of the descendants of the sons of Ham, the son of Noah. And in this cursed line of Canaan, you have this guy named Nimrod. Nimrod is a mighty hunter. He's a, you know, I think of whenever you see this this term mighty hunter, you think of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Conan the Barbarian, you know, kind of that idea. This, you know, and so Nimrod was a mighty hunter before the Lord, not in the sense that he was in God's favor, but perhaps in his in opposition to him, because what we see of Nimrod is that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar. From that, he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ur, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. So here we have Nimrod, who's a mighty hunter, but also a city builder. He built this city on rock and roll, right? No, and he's building the cities. What are some of the cities that are popping out that should sound familiar to you? Babel, Nineveh, Calneh, which I think is still there to this day. I think that's where modern day Nineveh is. But anyway, Nimrod is the city builder of what would become the archetypal opponents of God. And the one thing, if you're reading the Hebrew, it's more clear. Babylon is Babel. Okay, so the Hebrew word for Babylon is Babel. Okay, and so even in Isaiah, when he says an oracle against Babylon, it's against Babel. Okay, the term for this, at least, the reason why we call it Babel is because of what happened at the Tower of Babel, right? It's this idea where they can't understand each other, so it just sounds like they're saying Babel, 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 right? In the same way that people who didn't speak Greek in the first century were called what? Barbarians, right? Because it sounded like when they talked, it just said bar, 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 bar. So they're called barbarians. It's a, what is it? Onomatopoeia? Is that how you say it? A word that sounds like it means. And so, what happened at the Tower of Babel? Well, you have there, you have this instance of human pride, hubris, of trying to exalt yourself, to the heights of heaven, to deify yourself, to make yourself as if you are like God. It is man's best attempt to reach God on his own power. And what's fascinating, if you go, maybe this afternoon, read Genesis 11 and the account of the Tower of Babel, and they're like, we're going to build this tower, right? And we read that Yahweh went down to see what they were doing. So, you know, I don't know how high they got, but they didn't get high enough to the heavens because the Lord had to go down to go see what they're doing, and he struck judgment, okay? So here is the setting the stage for what is to come for Babylon. It is the archetypal sin city. It becomes the symbol of this fallen world system, as is clear in the book of Revelation. But it also literally would be the empire that rises to be the tool in the hands of the Lord to destroy the people of God. Okay, so let me pause there and ask if there's any questions. Okay. Oh yeah, Dawn. It's in Iraq. Okay, so I'm not entirely sure what, if there's a city there, maybe somebody else might know, but it would be more like southern Iraq, and, Nineveh would be, like a northeastern Iraq bordering on Syria. So I think the city of Tikrit, would be close to where ancient Nineveh was. So it's all in that Mesopotamian region between the Tigris and Euphrates, and the Babylonian Empire would be on the southern end of that. Assyria would be the northern end of that. But in order to get to Israel, they need to march up and around the desert, And so they would both be coming from the north. So both Assyria and Babylon, even though Babylon lies east, right, east of the land of Israel, they're thought of enemies coming from the north because that's where they'd be coming from when they march into town. Okay. Oh, the other thing I want to highlight here is the importance of the land of Israel. So I'll just, you know, I'll do my little map here. Okay, so here's Israel. Here's my map. This is the Mediterranean Sea, right? This would be the land of Israel. This is the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea, the Jordan River. Okay. What's down here? Egypt. Okay. Here's Israel. And then, of course, Babylon, Assyria would be, you know, in this area, but they would be coming this way. So it's really important for the trade routes to be able to go through here. So Israel was the land in between the major trading ports, right? So you have, you know, stuff coming from the east, you have Egypt with its wealth, right? And Israel is just kind of the go-between. So think of Israel like Orange County, right? Between San Diego and Los Angeles. To get to one, you got to go through. And so Israel, the land of Israel, was constantly in a tug of war between the powers of the south and the powers of the north. They wanted to be able to control this land. So this has been disputed territory for a long time. And that's why Israel is constantly just being tugged back and forth and under constant threat from the south, north, east, and west. Okay? So that's another thing kind of set the stage. All right, let's look into this this oracle against Babylon. There's many more, and Isaiah kind of goes in cycles where there's three different cycles where he'll address Babylon in one way, shape, or form three different times in the coming chapters, but also other nations. So verse 2, Isaiah 13, verse 2, on a bare hill, raise a signal. Cry aloud to them. Wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. I myself have commanded my consecrated ones and have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. The sound of a tumult on the mountains as of a great multitude. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. Yahweh of hosts is mustering a host for battle. They come from the distant land, from the end of the heavens. Yahweh and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Wail, for the day of Yahweh is near. As destruction from the Almighty it will come. Therefore all hands will be feeble, and every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor, and they will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of Yahweh comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. As I said, in these oracles, Isaiah addresses different nations, but then at some point he addresses the whole world. So this is sort of looking forward, telescoping to final day judgment. And even if you continue reading, it talks about the destruction of the whole earth, but then also the new heavens and new earth. So again, remember Isaiah is predicting on this timeline. I'll erase my map of Israel. He has his timeline where he's living in the 8th century BC, right? And he's predicting the destruction of Babylon, which will take place, you know, some 200 years later, but he's also, you know, predicting further out events with the birth of Christ and the end of the world with the second coming, okay? So there's multiple layers of fulfillment in all of these prophecies. Verse 12, I will make people more rare than fine gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of Yahweh of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And like a hunted gazelle or like sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own people and each will flee to his own land. Whoever is found will be thrust through, and whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Infants being dashed to pieces? Yeah. Was it Psalm 138, if I'm not mistaken? Psalm 137. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept. And remembered Zion, on the willows there we hung our lyres. For there our captors required of us songs and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing to us one of the songs of Zion. So here we have Isaiah writing in the 8th century of what's going to happen to Babylon. And then we have Israelites living in the 6th century in Babylon. In exile, weeping by the waters of Babylon, refusing to sing the songs of Zion. And then they say at the end of that psalm, O daughter of Babylon, Babylon, doomed to be destroyed. Blessed shall he be who repays you with what you have done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. We cringe when we read that, right? And we think, how can a Christian sing this? Well, let's think about how they sang it. Why were they, I mean, were they just getting creative there? You know, trying to think of creative ways to make the Babylonians feel uncomfortable? They're quoting from Isaiah. They're claiming the promises of God that Babylon will be destroyed. That the wicked, evil things that they did that the Babylonians did to them will come back on their head in judgment. So that's why they could say to Babylon, you're doomed for destruction. And they could proclaim a blessing upon the one who does it. Okay? Yes, Renee? No, they're pronouncing a blessing upon the agents to come. And so we'll actually see who that is. Isaiah identifies who that is. But the Israelites are praying this in faith, not that they're going to be doing it. Remember, it's blessed is he who does this. So it's not, they're not taking up swords against Babylonians. They're suffering for their sins and they know it, but they're looking forward to that agent of destruction to come. So that's why I talked about, that's why in Isaiah 10, when I mentioned how Assyria was that tool in God's hand. It was the rod of his fury. It was the axe in his hand. But then God, Isaiah is saying, woe to you, because it's going to come back and get you. So same thing with Babylon. It's going to come back to you, right? So that's what they're claiming a promise there from Isaiah's prophecy. Did I see a hand over here? No? Okay. All right. So who is that agent of destruction? Back in Isaiah 13. Now, remember, Isaiah's writing this in the 8th century. At this point, Babylon is struggling for its very own existence. And actually, one of their allies... One of the allies against the ascending Assyrian Empire were the Medes. Babylon was actually friendly with the Medes at this point. They're both struggling for existence. Look at verse 17. Behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men and will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the splendor of pomp of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherds will make their flocks lie down there. The wild animals will lie down there. And their houses will be full of howling creatures. Their ostriches will dwell. And there will goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers and jackals in the pleasant places. Its time is close at hand. And its days will not be prolonged. So you have, destruction of, foretelling of the destruction. It's just desolate. No people are there. It's become a zoo. Okay? It's for the wild animals to abide in. Questions, comments? Okay, so again, Shane? Yeah, his army and that nation. So the Medo-Persian Empire, which would eventually come, as if you know the rest of the story, that this is exactly who. And then later on, he'll identify Cyrus as the one who will allow the people to return. So, yep. No Arab will pitch his tent. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you know, I'll have to look at the Hebrew and see what is there. But yeah, basically it's the idea of, you know, people, yeah, you're not going to have people come into Babylon anymore, right? Like, you know, you think of Las Vegas, like that city should not exist. You get on the 15, you go, there's no good reason for anyone to live there, right? Somebody had the idea of, you know, open up a place where you could gamble, and there's reason for people to go to Las Vegas now. Maybe not good reasons, but it draws people to come. The idea here is no one will want to go to Babylon anymore. You're not going to want to go there and pitch a tent because people aren't there, right? So that's the idea. It's destruction. Okay, next Sunday, we're going to see, first of all, how, remember Isaiah, he wrote this, you know, for his contemporaries, but really it was people who would live later who could claim these promises, right? This wouldn't make sense for Isaiah's original audience. But really, as we're told in the New Testament, this is written for us. So how is it that we could look forward to the destruction of Babylon? And what sort of taunts are we going to be singing when that takes place? But also, in a certain sense, we're part of Babylon, right? And this is who we are by nature. So that's we'll be looking forward to that too. So let's close our time with prayer. Dear Lord Jesus Christ, we do thank you that you are the propitiation for the sins, not only of the Jews, but of the whole world. We thank you, O Lord, that we can be here calling upon your name, receiving the assurance of pardon, and living by your grace, even here on the other side of the world, some 2,000 years after your life, death, and resurrection. We pray that you would continue to empower us by your Spirit, lead us and guide us this week, gather us together again as we call upon your name. We ask this in your name.